The final investigator I chatted with for this program was Dr. Paul Richardson for what is always an almost mind-numbing cruise through the extensive clinical trial literature in multiple myeloma. Dr. Richardson began by reflecting back on the ASH meeting.
Well, Neil, I would say that there was a very busy ASH again for myeloma, and I think there were some important take-home messages from the meeting. The plenary session was given by Dr. Mary V. Mateos from a large randomized Spanish trial, which looked at novel therapies in the context of the non-transplant eligible older population. And the take-home message from her presentation was that certain combinations in the upfront setting seemed to be highly effective. She compared bortezomib, melphalan, and prednisone to bortezomib, thalidomide, and prednisone, and showed equal activity from the two, but different toxicology. More myelosuppression and infectious complications with VMP, but conversely, with the VTP combination, more neuropathy and cardiac issues. Having said that, they were manageable. Both regimens were exquisitely active, and what she showed very nicely was that bortezomib and thalidomide maintenance combined appeared superior to bortezomib maintenance alone with concomitant prednisone given every other day. So that, I think, was an important sort of take-home message, that the IMiD proteasome inhibitor combinations are very attractive, and that sort of validates a lot of clinical and preclinical work in that context. I think the other major messages from ASH were several, in fact. On the one hand, lenalidomide made a splash with the Palombo trial, where he compared MP lenalidomide to MP lenalidomide with lenalidomide maintenance versus MP alone. Well, no surprises that the winner was MP lenalidomide plus lenalidomide maintenance, but what was surprising was that MP lenalidomide versus MP actually did not look meaningfully different at the doses of lenalidomide used, which were 10 milligrams, which is relatively low. And certainly with early follow-up, the PFS differences between MP alone and MPR, as it was called, without maintenance, were actually superimposable. Now, I think that's a function of early follow-up. I think the curves will separate, would be my bet, particularly because the response rates were different. But having said that, I think the message is lenalidomide matters, and you need to be able to continue it. And also, frankly, is MP the best partner with lenalidomide? And I think that echoes very nicely with the publication of Vincent's landmark E4A03 trial looking at lenalidomide high-dose dex versus lenalidomide low-dose dex, where he clearly shows, and that was published in Lancet Oncology at the end of last year in full manuscript form, and it's a very nice paper and very informative. And I think what it says very clearly is that toxicity really matters, and what you put your novel drugs with is important, because there he clearly showed that high-dose dex is the wrong partner with lenalidomide. And my gut sense, Neil, from the MPR presentation was that M&P is not necessarily the right partner with lenalidomide either, because myelosuppression was an issue. And it seems that lenalidomide mattered, perhaps not the MP, if that isn't too heretical. So I was left with a sort of feeling that lenalidomide's important up front. I think it'll certainly get its approval on the basis of this trial. But I do think that it certainly left me thinking that, you know, one has to be thoughtful about the right partner in the older population. And I think in that regard, the other messages from ASH were several. We continue to have very promising data from the combination of bortezomib and lenalidomide, our own combination, the so-called RV-little-D or RVD combination. And we're showing that cytogenetics, if they're adverse, are certainly no different in terms of outcome, both not only for quality of response rate, but very importantly also for PFS, which is a harder marker of clinical benefit, as you know. So I think that the combination strategies are bearing fruit up front, that being on therapy for longer matters, and therefore the toxicity of any regimen really is important. I thought it was also very interesting to see the transplant data emerge, which really continued to support the fact that three-drug regimens pre-transplant are, in fact, better than two-drug regimens. And this was pretty convincing, actually, because there were updates from the CARVO trial, which looked at VTD versus TD. There was a very nice study from the French looking at a less intensive bortezomib schedule with thalidomide and dex versus bortezomib and dex alone, showing superiority to the three drugs over the two. But interestingly, the CR rate between the bortezomib dex and the bortezomib thalidomide dex were identical. And I think that just helps us understand that, consistent with the French message, which has always been since the original Harousseau trial showing the superiority of bortezomib and dexamethasone over VAD convincingly and showing no role Fadicep pre-transplant in either arm. The message from the IFM has been that bortezomib-based therapy pre-transplant is certainly in the French group's experience the standard of care now. And I think what the three drug combinations are saying is that, you know, now three drugs is probably the way to go over two. And the biggest issue then becomes managing toxicity and minimizing it. And Jean-Luc's conclusions were, how can we better strive to reduce neurotoxicity? And obviously, that's an important goal across the board. And in that regard, there was another presentation by Antonio Palombo looking at weekly bortezomib in the elderly population and showing convincingly that that weekly approach really does bear fruit in terms of being much less toxic. And very importantly, no significant loss of efficacy, particularly when you're using the drugs in combination. And I think then the sort of final message perhaps to share, because there were lots of them, but perhaps this would be a reasonable final one, would be the maintenance studies post-transplant. There was lenalidomide post-transplant by the French, which involved a consolidation step with lenalidomide and then a maintenance. And then there was from the CLGB under the leadership of Phil McCarthy from Roswell Park, and we were actually obviously part of that trial too, we showed that lenalidomide post-transplant in a randomized placebo-controlled fashion in the context of the ASH presentation was feasible, safe, and well tolerated. And then actually just shortly after the meeting, the CLGB announced the interim analysis that was positive in favor of the lenalidomide, and quite strikingly so. The French also had sort of preliminary data at the meeting, but then in January announced from the French trial a very impressive difference. Just to give you that, it will be actually updated at ASCO and presented in full form, I believe. But essentially what the French announced in January was that the progression-free survival for the transplant arm that received lenalidomide maintenance with a median follow-up of 3 years was 70%. The control arm was actually substantially lower than that at 35%. Now, that's going to be presented at ASCO by the principal investigator, Michel et al., is my understanding. And that information, I think, is very important.
So that obviously is a lot of stuff. Capsulizing it down, was there anything that came out of all these things that you mentioned that we'd put into the term that I hear being used more and more in terms of, quote, practice changing? Anything that you actually changed after that meeting in your own non-protocol management?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that pre-transplant, for transplant candidates, three-drug regimens, you know, are our own institutional standard. And our favorite, of course, is lenalidomide bortezomib dex, because we do find you have to be careful about the neurotoxicity, but the severity of it very rarely is severe. Having said that, one has to be careful about four drug regimens, you know, because there was some data from the Evolution trial showing extremely active, you know, validating the three drug platform, but there was actually treatment related mortality in one 4-drug combination in the Evolution study. So I think, you know, one has to be careful, but sort of practice changing message, 3-drug platform pre-transplant certainly seems to be a standard. The use of a proteasome inhibitor pre-transplant appears to be a standard. The role of the immunomodulators is continuing to go from strength to strength, both pre-transplant and post-transplant as maintenance. And on that note, for the older population, convincing data that the same sort of paradigm applies, that maintenance matters. And certainly in the older population, from the plenary session from Dr. Mateus, you know, some striking evidence that bortezomib maintenance, in fact, in the older population was both feasible and certainly in combination with the IMID did appear to be important. So another sort of practice-changing point is that if you want to minimize neurotoxicity, which I think outside of hematologic toxicity and infection is, I think, our biggest challenge, is that weekly bortezomib is associated with substantially less neurotoxicity. And by going to that schedule, particularly in combination, one can minimize the effects of neuropathy.
I've been trying to sort of sort out in my own mind the Palumbo weekly bortezomib thing ever since the last ASCO meeting. Initially, a couple people said to me, well, there wasn't as much dose given. I'm not sure it's going to be as efficacious. Now there's more data out there. I mean, for example, in your own non-protocol management and in the RVD regimen, how's the bortezomib given?
Well, that's a great question. I think in our clinical trial, it was given on a day 1, 4, 8, and 11 schedule for the first 6 months, for the first 8 cycles. And then in the second 6-month block of therapy, it was weekly. We had a substantial proportion of patients over the age of 70 in the trial. And in fact, the oldest patient in the trial was mine. He's actually just celebrated his 86th birthday, actually. Now, in those patients, we very quickly dose reduced per protocol to a weekly schedule. And I think the schedule is the point. And I kind of agree with you, Neil. I think once you go below a milligram per meter squared of bortezomib, you've got to watch out that you may be losing efficacy. But between 1 and 1.3, very active. And I think the weekly versus the twice weekly, particularly when you've got a combination, particularly when you've got other effective drugs like lenalidomide in the mix, it allows you that much more room to maneuver. And I think that we're exploring actually an RVD light concept for the older patient and about to launch into a phase two exploratory trial in that regard, based upon just what you're alluding to, which would be something like RVD times two cycles on the classical schedule and then dropping to weekly shortly thereafter. That's the current concept that we're working with. I think Antonio's data with more maturity is showing that his observation is very real, that he's able to retain activity with this weekly schedule. And the drop in significant neuropathy, which is what matters after all, you know, the grade threes or the painful grade twos, is dramatic. So I think that that's, to me anyway, the sort of practice-changing message is that obviously you don't want to lose your punch. So initially you might want to use your bortezomib twice a week for a couple of cycles. But then as soon as the tingling starts, as soon as that issue emerges, you can legitimately look to dose reduction and schedule change quickly, as long as you've got other drugs in the mix that are working.
And also getting back to this issue of what's happened that's practice changing, what about post-transplant maintenance? Are you there yet?
Oh, absolutely. No. I mean, I think the CLGB and French data are exactly sort of mirror images of each other. You know, Phil McCarthy's study at RCLGB trial is convincingly positive. And so is the French study. And I think their PFS data, I mean, it's preliminary and I want to see it fully presented, obviously, but it was announced publicly in January. I think there's no reason to doubt that the lenalidomide story post-transplant is real. I think the problem with thalidomide always was the cumulative toxicity. And whilst there are, in my practice, a number of patients who tolerated thalidomide long-term very well, they are, I have to say, the minority. That's in contrast, however, to lenalidomide, where I find that people on the long haul can tolerate lenalidomide much better in the majority. So it's a sort of different switch. The interesting question to me is, you know, in some patients, clearly lenalidomide alone is not enough. And I think that we've got some interesting data emerging, and it's particularly the Mateo study, which showed that bortezomib plus thalidomide was superior to bortezomib plus prednisone. And that makes sense to me, scientifically, absolutely makes sense. And so I think that what we're going to see hopefully emerging is more information regarding the two drugs as part of maintenance versus the one. And it may well be that a significant proportion of patients only need one, but there may be an important subgroup who need two.
You know, Keith Stewart was on our last program, and I want to congratulate you and him and also Dr. San Miguel on this fantastic paper that was in Blood in December on how I treat myeloma in younger patients, which actually gets into older patients also. Really a fantastic way to present the information. I recommend to everybody to take a look at. But I wanted to just ask you about a couple of things that come out in the paper. One of the things that I really liked that you did was look at the issue of, quote, what investigations should be done at first diagnosis. Yeah. And I really like the fact that you broke it down into essential for everybody, desirable, and investigational. Can you kind of go through that?
Yeah, no, thank you. And thank you for your kind comments. Keith really led the charge there, and it's a very nice paper. I bring people's attention to the actual final version. There was a slight erratum which will come out. It's not a big deal, but I do think it's an important point for people in practice. In the version that was published, in the abstract, unfortunately, at the galley level, they didn't remove the cure comment that was in the abstract. We actually didn't, as a group, want that in the abstract. So it's actually been taken out of the real final, which will be online shortly. And I say that only because I've had a bit of feedback from colleagues saying, my goodness, you guys used the cure word in the abstract.
Yeah, I see it says here in the abstract, quote, a reasonable goal of myeloma treatment in younger transplant-eligible patients is the target of durable complete remission and the anticipated consequence of long-term disease control. And I guess here's the controversy, parentheses, and a potential, quote, operational cure, end quote, in sum. Interesting.
Well, it is interesting, and it was actually, it's coming out. Because, no, I mean, you know, all joking aside, because for us in the trenches who are looking after the patients and looking after their families, using the C word in this context, you have to be extremely careful because in reality, the disease remains incurable. The question is, can you achieve durable remission that lasts? And can that last many years? And that's essentially what we wanted to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think operational cure kind of means that you're living with the disease, it's not causing you a problem, and you die of something else.
Yeah, well, and thank goodness that in some patients we're seeing that. But I have to stress that is in the very substantial minority.
Yeah, particularly, I guess, younger patients.
Well, exactly. And that's, to be honest, Neil, why in the final version that we wanted, Jesus, myself, and Keith, it was supposed to not have that in, and it was just a goof. You know, everyone understands that, and the Erotum will have that fixed. But in any event, I thank you for the rest of the comments, because Keith really led the charge, and I agree with you. It's a super paper. So the question is, what do you need to know? Well, we saw what was practical in the investigation, which is obviously cytogenetics, and that would be metaphase, cytogenetics, and FISH. Critically, beta-2 microglobulin, serum albumin. Other markers like LDH can be helpful. Plasma cell labeling index is obviously a big favorite at Mayo, and I think very valid based upon their work. But not everybody does it. For example, we don't. And it's not that we don't think it's important. It is, but it may not be feasible in all laboratories. And so for that reason, you have a sort of constellation of things you can look at. So what we sought to do is sort of say, what's the real bare necessities? Well, the bare necessities really revolve around your chem profile, your CBC, LDH, serum albumin, beta-2 microglobulin, very important. And of course, when you're doing the bone marrow, flow cytometry, also helpful, cytogenetics, critical, as well as FISH. And recognizing, though, the good news is that with agents like bortezomib and lenalidomide, we're increasingly seeing that the adverse impact of bad cytogenetics, and by that I mean things like 17 deletion, 414 translocation, 1416 translocation, those bad guys don't seem to matter as much as they used to. I don't think they don't matter anymore. That's probably far too strong a statement to make at this point, but they don't seem to matter as much in terms of both response and now evidence of PFS.
Is there ever an issue of repeating the bone marrow or deciding about whether repeating the bone marrow because maybe when it was done and myeloma wasn't suspected or for some reason people didn't send the cytogenetics?
Well, it's a great question. And I think if the cytogenetics weren't done and the FISH wasn't done, I think still at this stage, it's very reasonable within the confines of being sensible. I mean, if you have a very elderly patient who doesn't like bone marrows, did a terrible time with the marrow that was done, and you've got enough to make your treatment decision, no one's going to say you did the wrong thing by not going back in again to get more information. But if you have, conversely, you know, a young, healthy adult patient who hopefully will have 10 to 15 years potentially of disease control, knowing what you have then may matter. Because I think it's a dynamic process, Neil. It can change. And I think that's an important message too, is that, you know, I've seen patients in whom we'll start with normal metaphase cytogenetics and unrevealing FISH. And then in the relapsed refractory setting, 3 or 4 years later, you know, it's a different animal that we find when we repeat the FISH and the cytogenetics. And that can actually help because at the end of the day, you know, that can guide you certainly insofar as to say this patient needs a novel agent-based combination strategy for salvage.
Now, you know, we'll get into this with your cases, but it's been my take in talking to you over the last couple of years, as you just said, that you're generally starting out with triple therapy and almost everybody.
Right.
So how do these tests in terms of, and particularly the high risk factors, affect the way you manage patients?
Well, I think they influence you in the following way. I mean, for example, we do believe that in most patients, continuing on some form of treatment matters. And if you're sitting down with your patient and they're saying, yeah, well, you know what, some of the side effects here are really a challenge. Obviously, you'll work hard to minimize them no matter what. But obviously, if you've got someone with a very scary picture, you know, 17 deletion, 414, 1416, you know, bad-looking marrow, plasmablastic features, and you know that they've had a wonderful response. I mean, a classic example might be someone with an IgA isotype and 414 translocation, and they'll have had a CR, because often IgA patients respond beautifully. The problem is they come back fast. And the thing is that if you had an adverse cytogenetic picture there, you might say, well, look, you know, I know you've responded beautifully. I know we've got a lovely CR here, but you're someone I think we need to think hard about this maintenance, and perhaps we can really try and manage some of the side effects you're encountering, but we do need to think about keeping you on something. So those are the kind of nuances that I think this information helps you with.
Now, another thing that you all go into in the paper is the concept of, quote, durable complete response is a desirable endpoint. I think this ties in a little bit to this operational cure thing you were talking about, of aggressive versus maybe not so aggressive. What was the point you were trying to get across there?
Well, you know, clearly we think that CR matters broadly. It doesn't matter in everyone. Clearly there's a heterogeneity to myeloma that I think all of us in the clinic are very familiar with. And we're behind our lymphoma colleagues in that we're struggling to define the subgroups to some extent, but I think we're getting much better at it. And I think that in the majority of patients, particularly in younger patients, which is why I think that How I Treat paper allowed us to, you know, be fairly strong about the importance of CR, because in younger patients, it probably does matter in the majority. Older patients, it's a different set of considerations, but it still seems, particularly if you look at the VISTA data, now you look at the data from Marie V. Mateos, and indeed also Antonio's work from the Italian group, the same message is coming through every time, that, you know, quality of response translates to better outcome. And I think that if we can achieve that with toxicity that is manageable and a side effect profile that is rational, you know, it's a very reasonable goal. I mean, it's funny because I sit down with my leukemia colleagues and they say, well, that's a no-brainer, isn't it? And then, and of course, to them it is. But of course, myeloma is a reticuloendothelial illness, obviously is a somewhat different animal. But nonetheless, broadly speaking, I think it's fair to say that depth and quality of response is important.
Another part of the paper I liked related to the use of higher dose corticosteroids, for example, patients with severe hypercalcemia who need a rapid response.
Well, exactly in that, and in renal failure too. And obviously, goes without saying, in patients with cord compression and those kind of oncologic emergencies. I think the essence of steroids is they're truly a double-edged sword, and that they're useful acutely to stabilize patients rapidly. If you have someone with bad renal disease and there's a lot of metabolic disturbance, always remember the value of solumedrol. It's a mineralocorticoid as well as a glucocorticoid, and I find, frankly, when I've got someone in real trouble with myeloma kidney, it's worth remembering that they can be profoundly hyponatremic because they may have a very high M spike, for example, because, you know, you get a sort of factitious effect. But nonetheless, they're metabolically difficult to sort out. So always remember solumedrol. I particularly like it, actually, because I think it's better tolerated, actually, than Dex. But obviously, Dex is the blessing of being oral. But anyway, nonetheless, having said that, I think higher doses of steroids can really matter in certain contexts. But the real issue is the duration, in my experience, and particularly in older patients. And I like to be able to go to a steroid-sparing approach as quickly as possible. And I think that's the beauty of the three-drug regimens, is that they allow you to do that. I do think, however, it's important to note that glucocorticoids do matter, and not just in the context of anti-tumor effect, but they really can help with some of the side effect issues. And one of the most interesting things at the ASH meeting, and I'm part of actually both studies, obviously, the RVD phase 1-2 trial that we ran, where we partnered the dexamethasone with the bortezomib on days 1, 2, 4, 5, 8, 9, and 11, 12. The grade 3 neuropathy signal we had in the RVD trial was just one patient out of 66, so a very small number. Now, I do want to stress we were looking very hard for neuropathy. And in fact, when we looked over the whole life cycle of the trial in all the patients, grade 1 was in around 50%, grade 2 in about 27%, and then there's just one grade 3. So, you know, it's a high overall rate, but the grade 3 was in just one. Now, in the Evolution trial, Neil, which used a different scheduling of Dex, and we were part of this trial, and it was led by Shaji Kumar and Vince Rajkumar from Mayo. What Shaji chose was to put the Dex in the classic Rev-Dex schedule. So the Dex was given on days 1, 8, 15 of each cycle. And interestingly enough, the grade 3 signal of neuropathy was much higher. Now, you may say, well, you obviously remember these are cross-trial comparisons, so one has to be very careful. But you might also say, well, it's a different study group, you know, they weren't as familiar with. No, it actually wasn't. Oddly enough, we were certainly the second lead enroller to that trial. And we saw this neuropathy signal bounce. So I wonder about the importance of Dex scheduling. And I think, and certainly when you're thinking about things like bortezomib, remember it may matter where you place your steroid. And the science behind it may be that the neuropathy in myeloma is very complicated, and the mechanisms of neurotoxicity of the drugs are different. But part of the neuropathy of bortezomib may have an inflammatory component, and that being the case, using the steroid around the bortezomib may matter. And I'm sorry to spend time on that, but I just think it's such an important practice point for community docs to hear, because, you know, it's a nuance that would be very easy to miss if you're just scanning the literature.
I think it also ties into the issue of toxicity of three-drug regimens like RVD. You've been telling me for a long time now that your belief was that it wasn't more toxic than two drug regimens, and you know that maybe the suggestion's even less toxic. Yet I have other people, even people who've put patients on your study, who said, well, use three drugs versus two, you're going to get more toxicity. What's the actual truth of the matter?
Well, I think it's very interesting because I think it's really a story in evolution. The evolution trial, actually it's funny to say that, because the evolution trial has been a very good effort, because a randomized phase two, you see, and with a randomized phase two, it's simply not powered to give you much of an efficacy difference,
right.
But what it is telling us is a toxicity difference. Now, the CRVD or the CVRD combination, the four-drug one, that was the one associated with treatment mortality. There were two deaths on treatment, one definitely related and the other possibly, you know, maybe was downscored. But in any event, there was treatment-related mortality on that arm. And one of the patients I had on that arm actually got tophilitis, for example, which is a first for me in the non-transplant setting. So I think the CRVD combination can be tough. Having said that, it's very active. Conversely, Keith Stewart's regimen, which is CyBorD or CVD, that was well tolerated, quite active, especially when they increased the cyclophosphamide dose. But interestingly, the overall neurotoxicity signal was higher, and it was higher than both arms, both the CRVD and the other RVD or VRD arm, depending on what you want to call it. And actually, it may be better to call it VRD because of the different DEX schedule. But in any event, the VRD arm had a very similar neuropathy signal to the CRVD arm. But what was different and important was that the grade 3 neuropathy was worse than I would have expected based upon what we've seen. So I think the answer, Neil, is that the toxicities are being worked out, but it's not an immediate answer. And I think that IMIDs plus proteasome inhibitors, we definitely see myalgias and a kind of neuropathy signal that's complex. We're trying to figure out how best to reduce it. And I think one of the most important steps is the clue is, frankly, from the Palumbo data, that by reducing the bortezomib to weekly, that in and of itself is going to be a very important step in bringing down these rates of neuropathy.
Now, another topic you get into with this paper, and I love the paper in terms of the fact it seems like you really focused on some of the key questions that people are asking themselves about it. But another thing that you deal with is how much treatment before stem cell transplant and actually the role of transplant itself.
Right.
And it's interesting. I'm looking at this paper and wondering, you know, because it got published in December. I guess you didn't have the ASH stuff, you know, whether it's actually some of it has changed in your own mind. But anyhow, what about stem cell transplant and myeloma? Where are we with it today?
Well, I think that what has impressed me again and again is that, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a real question, would novel therapies replace transplant? And I think right now, absolutely not. What we're seeing is that transplant is being made better with novel therapies, both before and after. What is good news is that the role of tandem transplantation, and I say this when I say good news, because obviously, if tandems really help, of course, they should be thought of positively. I have to say, in my experience, the second transplant is very challenging. And while some patients sail through it, in the majority of my experience, the second transplant is often quite tough. The good news is that we don't seem to need two, because essentially one plus novel appears to be as good, if not better, than two plus novel. Certainly, at least the French view on that is pretty clear. I think it's perhaps more of an open question elsewhere. So I think transplant in a single intensification with a second one kept in reserve if a patient enjoys a long, durable, disease-free survival period is very reasonable. I think another very interesting paper at ASH that was presented actually was by Shaji Kumar again from the Mayo group. And Shaji looked at the Mayo experience of either Thal-Dex or lenalidomide Dex up front, followed by either early or late transplant, and he showed no survival difference for late versus early. This was a retrospective review. What he did show quite nicely as well, which I thought was interesting and actually just been published in Blood, was that certainly in their comparison, thalidomide Dex did not perform as well as lenalidomide Dex up front. And that's actually just been published in Blood. So I think that a couple of messages around transplant. Your induction regimen matters, and we already touched on, you know, the central role that bortezomib plays. Certainly as the data is emerging, the role of an IMID is clear, I think, both pre and post. And that you probably don't need two transplants in the vast majority of patients. One will suffice. And I think the key question then is, well, are there groups of younger patients in whom transplant can be legitimately delayed? And we don't know the answer to that, frankly. It is certainly feasible, and it's certainly a choice that patients very reasonably make frequently. In France, for example, where it's much more of a system where essentially by virtue of resources and so on, choices are not necessarily the rule. In fact, follow treatment plans as the IFM recommend. And in France, for example, they don't do delayed transplant. So we're actually partnered with them in a very large trial that's about to start later this year. Looking at exactly this question, we're going to use the lenalidomide bortezomib dex platform as initial treatment. We're going to mobilize with cyclophosphamide, collect stem cells, and then we will either, in a randomized fashion, transplant early or transplant late. And in both arms, there will be post-consolidation lenalidomide bortezomib therapy and then maintenance to follow. And I hope that will help us answer the question that you're asking. And I think certainly for now, patients with advanced stage disease by ISS, probably transplant early still matters. For those patients who are truly an ISS stage 1, for example, who have an excellent response to induction, collecting them and waiting and giving them some sort of maintenance in the interim is, I think, a very reasonable choice for patients.
And you also comment in the paper about the issue of mobilization of stem cells and also specifically about the issue of lenalidomide. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think it's a very interesting one because, again, just like the toxicity question, you need time to sort of sort out what's going on. I think what we've learned about lenalidomide is that it's a myelosuppressive agent, but it is not a myelotoxic agent, if you see what I mean. And in terms of the stem cell mobilization question, it can blunt your ability to mobilize stem cells if you try and do it immediately around lenalidomide. But if you actually delay or wait, you can actually mobilize quite successfully. And very importantly, plerixafor appears to have been a major step in the right direction in that regard. So you can actually mobilize off plerixafor and GCSF. You can mobilize off cyclophosphamide and GCSF, in my experience, relatively consistently, satisfactorily, after an induction strategy with an IMID, lenalidomide and bortezomib, for example. So I think that the stem cell mobilization question, which was a legitimate worry about a year and a half ago, I think, we're beginning to understand better. And I think that mobilization is less of a concern as long as one adopts, you know, the sort of smart approaches to it.
Let's talk about your cases. And if we could, I'd like to begin with your 75-year-old man.
So yes, well, this is, I hope, an informative case. A 75-year-old gentleman who presents with a very typical picture, actually, upper respiratory tract infection. It's important to remember that in myeloma, sinopulmonary infection is a very common issue because patients have immunoparesis by virtue of having profound hypogammaglobulinemia often or dysfunction of their uninvolved immunoglobulins. And he also had chest discomfort, which actually, as it was ascertained, was due to not just the fact that he was coughing and sputtering, but also because he actually had bony disease in his ribs. And he had a very classic presentation with an M protein measured at 3.81 grams per deciliter. He was found by immunofixation to have IgG lambda gammopathy. And he was actually had a reasonably intact hemoglobin at 12.7. He had Bence-Jones proteinuria. And when we looked at his beta 2 microglobulin, it was 3.4, and his serum albumin was 3.5. So, smack on the nose, a sort of stage 1 patient by ISS classification. I always like to, you know, look at the bone disease as well in detail, and he had osteopenia and scattered lytic lesions in the skull. He also had significant rib involvement. So, actually, by Drury Salmon, he had a number of rib lesions. And so, in fact, he was a 3A by Drury Salmon. And if we looked at his CT, which was actually done to further evaluate his ribs, he did in fact have quite a substantial lesion of the right posterior seventh rib with some cortical destruction and extraosseous soft tissue extension. Very typical picture here. The remainder of his evaluation was uninformative, I would say. We did actually do a PET CT and there was a hypermetabolic destructive lesion was confirmed. And the remainder of the PET CT was quite helpful, but it did show more extensive rib disease, as well as disease in his pelvis and also in his lumbar spine. So a very typical 3A by Drury Salmon, stage 1A by ISS, but very borderline in that regard. It'd be interesting to see, you know, if we'd monitored his albumin a couple of times more, I bet it would have actually fallen into stage 2 territory because this guy clearly had aggressive disease.
Any comorbidities or is he in good health?
You know, actually he was in good health. The interesting thing is that his cytogenetics were interesting. They're sort of mixed. He had trisomy of 11, which is more favorable. It's important to remember that any abnormal cytogenetics is not good. But if you have trisomy 11, that's not bad. And he had deletion 13 by FISH, which again, on its own, is not necessarily a bad thing. It is a bad thing if you get it by metaphase cytogenetics, and it is a bad thing if it partners with other things like 414 and so on. So the interesting question is here, you know, this gentleman got bisphosphonate intravenously, and actually he did get some radiation too, because his lesion in his seventh rib was actually very painful. So that actually did receive some radiation. But the question is, you know, what would you offer in terms of upfront treatment? And in that regard, you know, we've got, he's a 75-year-old gentleman, so he's not a candidate for transplant, but he's an otherwise well man. And so MP would be one old thought.
Can I just pick up on that? If he were 70, would he be a transplant candidate?
Well, it's a great question. I think certainly in Europe, no. You know, 65 is their cutoff because it's a different set of healthcare systems. They're pretty cut and dried about that. In the US, obviously, we have choices. And a young, very healthy 70-year-old man without any significant comorbidity would be a very reasonable candidate, in my view, particularly if that's what the patient wanted, you know, with the appropriate counseling and fully being informed. We use a sort of biological cutoff, essentially, rather than truly a chronological one. But it's important to remember that high-dose melphalan can make your very sprightly, healthy 72-year-old man look 78 quickly in the wrong context. So we are quite careful, though, about autografting in the older patient, for sure. But there are data showing lower dose regimens, for example, and actually the Europeans in that regard are quite innovative with lower dose alkylation regimens as well in the older population. So it's not a chronological cutoff. But in any event, this gent's actually clearly a healthy, but clearly 75-year-old gentleman. So the other options that one would have on the table would be MPT, obviously. That's an approved combination. A similarly approved combination would be bortezomib, melphalan, and prednisone. Based upon the Palumbo data, another option would be the MPR regimen. One could think of lenalidomide and low-dose dexamethasone a la ECOG, for example. Or, of course, in our context at our center, lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, RV with a little D, would be one other attractive option.
In trying to sort those out, what did you actually discuss with him? Did you make one recommendation and give him a number of options?
Yeah, we discussed all of the options with him. And essentially, in this context, this gentleman was a protocol candidate. So essentially, that was one option. But again, let's pretend he wasn't and just focus as if this was a community-based setting.
What protocol was he eligible for, incidentally?
Oh, he was at that time, he was eligible for the RVD upfront study.
Right, okay.
But the thing is that outside of protocol, because, you know, these situations are dependent on whether or not a patient can come and so on, off protocol, how would one consider him? Well, I think that a couple of points to make about this gentleman. One point to make is his bone disease, and he's got a plasmacytoma with some soft tissue extension. You know, one has to be careful of these patients because extramedullary disease is not a good finding. And whilst everyone says, well, if you see FISH 13 deletion, don't worry, it's not a problem, it's nonetheless worth noting. So he has 13 deletion, he's got extramedullary disease, he's clearly symptomatic, he's got a lot of bone involvement, he's borderline in terms of his ISS. I mean, you can't say this is a guy who's a solid ISS stage 1A who's going to have an indolent biology. I don't think there's any evidence for that. This clinical presentation is not consistent with that. And I think that's the important message to community docs is it's not cookie cutter. There's an element of weighing each aspect. So in this particular guy's case, actually, we recommended that he have as part of his backbone a proteasome inhibitor because of its excellent activity in bone. And also the fact that it's, we believe it's important when you've got extramedullary involvement. We're obviously firm believers in the IMID platform, so lenalidomide would be an ideal choice, and a lower dose steroid approach would be reasonable. Now, it would be quite okay to think about bortezomib, melphalan, and prednisone in this gentleman. It would also be reasonable to think about melphalan, prednisone, and lenalidomide, I would argue. I'd be a bit more cautious in an older man of MPT. In days gone by, sure, but you know, you've got a less toxic IMID now, with less non-heme side effects. The only problem with MPR in this gentleman, again, is this problem of count suppression. But in this guy, actually, his counts weren't a problem. He had an intact CBC, essentially.
So what happened?
Well, we actually gave him, there'll be no surprises here, we gave him lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. He did quite well with it. He did get some myalgias. He did get grade 2 non-painful peripheral neuropathy, which score it as moderate. And there was significant fatigue. Emotional ability from steroids is an issue, and that is something to be aware of. But in any event, he did very well, had an excellent response.
So did he manifest emotional ability?
Well, I mean, I say this just as a teaching point. He clearly felt great when he got his steroids. Over time, though, particularly in older patients, beware of the cyclothymic effects of steroids. And the best person to liaise with is actually the patient's partner because they'll tell you what they're really like. I mean, the patient, depending on where they are in their steroid cycle, say, I'm feeling great. And, you know, the partner will look at you longingly and say, you know, he's actually a werewolf, you know. I'm exaggerating for emphasis, but you take the point. So I think there can be, particularly in the elderly, and especially with dexamethasone, that is a concern. But in any event, this patient achieves an excellent response to treatment. And interestingly, on re-imaging, has an excellent improvement in the plasmacytoma, and indeed no evidence of progressive disease in the bone. He remained, however, immunofixation positive, and he had received 6 months of bortezomib-based therapy. So the question is, you know, he's a near CR, what do you do now?
What would the options be, and what did you do?
Well, the options would be several, I think. On protocol, patients had the option of continuing on lenalidomide and bortezomib without the dexamethasone on day 1-8 every 21 days. Off protocol, a similar paradigm could be pursued, although one very reasonably could, for example, say, well, you know, in an older gentleman like this, perhaps it would be reasonable to give him a trial without bortezomib and basically focus on something like lenalidomide alone and continuing with bisphosphonate. Now, reasonably, the addition, you know, some people would say, well, what about the dexamethasone? Well, I already alluded to that in this gentleman's case, whilst he certainly didn't have steroid psychosis or anything as dramatic as that, he didn't like them. They made him gain weight and he had this, you know, mood fluctuation, etc. So getting away from dexamethasone would be important. The other message is, and this is an important one, Neil, is that dex is not a good drug for bone disease. I mean, over time, it's osteolytic in and of itself, and therefore it's not a great drug if you've got someone whose bone disease is a dominant feature of their illness. Minimizing steroid may be important. So I think in this gentleman's case, you have the option of lenalidomide-based maintenance with or without bortezomib. You know, I certainly wouldn't look to increasing his treatment or trying to consolidate him with melphalan and prednisone. I just don't think there's any justification for that in this particular gentleman's case. I think what one could reasonably do is offer him some form of maintenance.
So what actually happened?
Well, actually, with him, we offered him lenalidomide and we continued his solindronic acid, which is what he was on for his bone disease. And we actually had him on lenalidomide at 15 milligrams a day. And because he really didn't want to continue to come in for IV therapy regularly, we put him on a 3 week on, 1 week off schedule of the lenalidomide at 15 and continued solindronic acid.
And what's the situation right now?
Well, reevaluation about a month ago, he's actually entered a CR. And his tolerance of treatment has been really quite good. Interestingly, there was a little bit of a worry about a rash off the steroid from the lenalidomide, but it was very mild, histaminergic, and seemed to settle down, and it's not been an issue going forward. An interesting question is, you know, how long would one continue the lenalidomide now? And what would you also do about the zolindronic acid now that he's entered a CR?
And what are your answers to those?
Well, it's a great question. I think that the question of the lenalidomide is pretty clear as best as we can tell. He's tolerating it well. I should mention he is on aspirin because that's an important point. Patients on the IMIDs should be on some form of thromboprophylaxis.
Mini aspirin, right?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that 81 certainly is effective. The one thing I've found which is interesting is that I alternate between the two depending on my worry about any GI intolerance for the higher dose aspirin. I don't think we know exactly the answer, which is the better aspirin. The FDA recommendation is the full dose, 325. One interesting side effect about long-term lenalidomide, which people may not appreciate, is there is this irritable bowel syndrome that emerges. It's an unusual thing, but it can become a problem, and you need to use antidiarrheals, and there are various strategies to try and minimize it. Again, not quite entirely sure what the mechanism is behind that diarrhea, but in any event, it's usually manageable with supportive care. And one reasonable question, is there any inflammatory component to this bowel syndrome? Is it easier to sort of inflate? I don't think we have any evidence for that. So anyway, going back to the thromboprophylactic story, I use either 325 or 81. And the other side effect that I worry about with lenalidomide long-term is this irritable bowel. And there are various strategies that can be used to do it. Dose reduction actually does clearly help. Anyway, the other question, Neil, is the zolindronic acid. And our own policy is for up to 2 years to continue on a monthly schedule, particularly in someone like this with a bone disease as a feature of their newly diagnosed illness. And then at 2 years, can consider going to a less frequent schedule, either every 3 months, for example. We just finished our randomized ZMARC study in terms of enrollment, where we were randomizing to either monthly zolindronic acid or 3 monthly zolindronic acid based upon a urinary telopeptide assessment. If it was less than 50, they got 3 monthly, and if it was over 50, the NTX was over 50 from a 24-hour sample, they would get monthly.
Yeah, we had your colleague Ken Anderson in our studio in Miami for a day talking about bone-directed therapy. We actually had breast, myeloma, and prostate cancer investigators together. One of the things we were talking about is the new RANK ligand inhibitor, denosumab. What do you think about that, particularly as it relates to myeloma?
Well, denosumab, the data in myeloma, it's certainly safe and feasible. Interestingly, they did see some osteonecrosis of the jaw, albeit at a low level, but it wasn't absent. I think it's very promising. I think that it's a useful adjunct to the bisphosphonates in the sense that obviously we have on the one hand the bisphosphonates, on the other hand we have denosumab, and on the other hand we also have drugs now targeting DKK1, for example, which I think are very exciting. I think myeloma bone disease is an incredibly important target because it is such a key sanctuary site for the illness. You know, it's how it escapes drugs that target the marrow, in my view. So I think that the whole area of research into cortical bone involvement is really important. From a practical management point of view, I think the use of bisphosphonates remains a mainstay of the management of myeloma bone disease. And I think we've gotten much smarter about minimizing ONJ, you know, by avoiding dental extractions whilst you're on zoledronic acid, for example, and dental hygiene, et cetera, et cetera. I think also we know that certain drugs really help bone disease. For example, clearly bortezomib through its effect on activating the osteoblast. I think we also have preliminary evidence that lenalidomide may be better than thalidomide in the context of myeloma bone disease. And I think denosumab will hopefully provide us with another option. But I do think there is a need for some more clinical trials with denosumab in myeloma, certainly at this point.
I guess one thing that I came away kind of really thinking about after that day was, you know, the place of bone-targeted therapy in myeloma now in the era with the novel agents on board. I mean, can we just assume that it's just as important as it used to be? Or, you know, maybe is it different now that we have much more active therapy?
Yeah, it's a great question, Neil, as always. I think the important message is, though, that it's an important sanctuary site. And the drugs we have, the IMiDs are great marrow drugs. You know, they are wonderful at targeting the bad guys in the marrow. Bortezomib is too. Problem is, we're seeing myeloma increasingly move to extramedullary sites, be they purely skeletal or even extraskeletal. And I think it's important people say, oh my goodness, that's because of your new drugs. It's important to understand, actually, it's not. I mean, this illness is a reticuloendothelial illness. And if you look back to the original descriptions of myeloma back in the 70s, everyone talks about hepatomegaly and splenomegaly. And there's a very interesting autopsy series. Last author is Norton Greenberger, where Norton showed that in 65 consecutive autopsy patients, 40% involvement of the liver was documented. And I think it's important to remember that this disease doesn't just live in the marrow. It lives outside. And if you give it a hard enough time in the marrow, it will up sticks and move elsewhere. So I think that, you know, I wish we could say, don't worry about bone disease. I think absolutely not. I think it's the opposite. I think we need to redouble our efforts, actually, in better strategies for bone, because I think that's a site of treatment failure. And I think it's very interesting, because if you think about it, it makes sense that transplant with myeloablative therapy, why does it fail? Why is it not curative? Well, because the guys are able to dodge the bullet. And that's probably because they've got sanctuary, functional sanctuary sites in things like cortical bone and elsewhere. And that gets obviously to the interesting debate about what is the myeloma stem cell. And Ken and I feel very much that it's not just one cell, that it's actually a functional unit of tumor and microenvironment that's able to resist what we currently have.